Since 1993, this program has existed to document and create greater awareness of whole systems approaches. The notion of holism suggests that an emphasis on the whole rather than the parts is the foundation for more effective and less expensive ways of addressing the issues that affect our lives as people living in an industrial society like ours. It was clear to me over 10 years ago that holism was the answer, and that impulse has only been strengthened since then in talking with innovators, authors, and activists like the person in our studio today. James O'Dea was the director of the Washington, D.C. office of Amnesty International, a respected human rights organization, but likened his work there to an ambulance rescue. Today, he heads the Institute of Noetic Sciences, or IONS, and joins us to talk about the organization, how he was led to an understanding of the importance of a whole systems perspective, and how that led him to a life of service. James, a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks. Very good to be with you.
IONS is an amazing organization. In fact, I attended the 2002 conference in Vancouver, and a friend I met there signed me up to be a member. So I guess I'm a member of the organization.
Great. Very good. I hope it doesn't impinge on your objectivity.
No, I like to ask the devil's advocate questions, I think, because if you ask those kinds of questions, people without anything to hide usually welcome them to clear up any misunderstandings, and so they will be coming. Mm-hmm. But for those unfamiliar with the Institute of Noetic Sciences, tell us a little bit about the history and mission of the organization.
The organization was founded by the astronaut Edgar Mitchell, who was the sixth man to walk on the moon, and on his way back to Earth, and I think it's significant that it was on his way back rather than on his way up and out, coming back down to Earth, he had an experience of oneness, of the connection between all life and existence. Some would call it a mystical experience. Edgar was an MIT-trained scientist, so he really wanted to understand at also a scientific level what had happened to him, how all of those boundaries had dissolved, and he was experiencing oneness. So he created an institute to look at those issues, and the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Noetic comes from the Greek word nous. It really is meaning spiritual or intuitive mind, but the way I like to describe it sometimes is it's that part of the mind, that vast part of the mind, that cannot be squeezed into the little space of the rational mind, which is a guarded territory, as we know, with its polarities, and it's either ors, it's right and wrongs, it's up and downs, and thank God for it. I mean, it does help us get around the rational mind, but to confuse it with the vast places of the human soul and spirit and mind is self-delusional, and to become overly conditioned by the rational mind, and to think that your little corner of the rational mind where you think that your belief systems are right and the only way is hyper-delusional.
There is a poster with Allen Ginsberg's picture on it in the other room that says something to the effect of, and I'm paraphrasing and I hate when I do that, but inner skull vast as outer skull. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what's outside the world, the universe, and the universe is as vast as what's inside one's head. So I think
Indeed.
That's he's saying the same thing. When you were 11, you wanted to be a priest and escaped your boarding school, which has got to be a great story. Can you tell us first about wanting to be a priest at such an early age and then the escape?
You really have been digging in my... Yes.
I've been digging into your linen, in fact, which aided your escape.
Great. Yes, it was an interesting experience in my own growth and development that I persuaded my parents that I wanted to go to this lonely and remote part of England in the Cheshire Moors because I felt a deep spiritual calling. And in my own immature way, could not handle what became, after a few years, a whole series of internal inconsistencies in the experience there. And so rather than just ending it quietly, I threw some sheets down in the night and headed off. But at about age 14, had really left the Catholic Church and began a journey of sort of trying to understand the relationship between the truths that I was born with and other forms of truth. And I'm deeply grateful to the Catholic Church for what it gave me. I mean, when you think of, you know, this aspect of communion that is in the sacred rituals of the Catholic Church, as a seven-year-old to have a practice where you are essentially asked to commune with the divine, ingest the divine, it's a very good practice. But as a meaning set, it, you know, at age 14, it was no longer working for me. And one of the things that we talk about at the Institute of Noetic Sciences is worldviews, and how do you form your own particular worldview? How do you make your meaning? What is consistent and what is not consistent? And I think we have a value at this time when we talk to people about how do you form your worldviews? What is coherent and what is incoherent? I like to talk sometimes about the problem of hypercoherence, when a meaning system is no longer able to relate effectively to other meaning systems and starts to become hypercoherent because it has to prove that its own internal reference points are the only valid reference points. And it is really the collapse of meaning and the beginning of fundamentalism, which we see in many forms these days, not just in
the United States.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, these are the, this is what I'm after when I ask people to tell us about their background. 11 years old, you knew you wanted to be a priest. One part of that story you didn't get into is that your escape was successful. You made it from, you know, remote England back to Ireland. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah.
Trying to sort of reconnect with whatever it was in my childhood, because my family had left Ireland and moved to England.
But the hitchhike, or how did it happen? I'm assuming you didn't have any money, or very little money.
I actually stole the money. Now you're really exposing me. It's good. I stole the money in order to and we repaid it to the. But I had plotted my escape, and I think there is a part of my personality that is always sort of enjoyed the adventure. If you look at my life, I've been in civil wars and wars in various places, and gone to, Guatemala. At one point, I went with Jennifer Harbury, you know, looking for her husband's body. So that call to danger or adventure was there, and interesting, not a lot of moral qualms about what I needed to do for my own being to sort of break out of something that was suffocating me in some ways. And I think that is an important motif too, as to how do we grow? Of course, how do we grow without becoming criminals and so forth? But it was clearly evidence that at this young age, I needed to break through, and found the means to do so. And indeed, it was fascinatingly scary to drag my suitcase through this lonely landscape. And I remember about 3 or 4 miles from the place where the seminary was, in the middle of the night, and I was a little scared, finding what you can find in the English countryside, a red telephone box, where you could make a telephone call. I mean, I don't know what it was doing in the middle of the countryside, but there it was. And I went in and I called the operator, and I asked what time it was. But my real purpose was to hear a human voice to give me a little security and help me deal with what I had called upon myself.
That's a delightful story. It's amazing. We're talking with James O'Dea, president of the Institute of Noetic Sciences. I'm Paul Nelson. Now, had you gone on to a life of crime, I'm sure it would be a different story, but we can look back on that and say, well, you stole the money to escape and create this life where you're working in a life of service, working for Amnesty International and other fine organizations so that you'll be excused, I guess, in the eyes of the objective listener. Speaking of Amnesty International, you spent 10 years there, but ultimately you say that you ran out of rage. You burnt yourself out there. Mm-hmm. Explain that.
There is a sense that when you're confronted by the horror of the torture chamber and what is done to humanity on a daily basis, that the only immediate thing you can do is shout back with as much moral outrage as you can muster, stop the torture, stop the violations. And Amnesty is effective in certain ways in doing that, in bringing the alarm bells to the attention of the world and to individual governments. But it became an interesting challenge for me. I remember at one point also Iqbal Masih, I think he was 12 years old, 11 or 12 years old, when he was murdered in Pakistan. And at 8 years old, he had become a human rights activist because for a few years he had been one of those kids who had been shackled to a loom in Pakistan. And he received the Reebok Human Rights Award and went back to Pakistan and was a child activist and was murdered. And I went home and I was talking to my sons. I have three sons. And I was saying, you know, Iqbal Masih was murdered today. And, you know, he was a phenomenal being and we have to do something about it. And we would have this family process where we'd go around the table and you know, one of my sons said, who's next to talk, said, yes, and, you know, in our soccer game, I scored a goal today, and that's, and it was such a wonderful meaning shift for me, and I realized I'm a little over the top here. I'm trying to proselytize my own children. And in fact, we did have a wonderful conversation some days later about Iqbal Masih, but I realized that there was that sense of pushing it, you know. I also realized that it was about pointing the finger at others. It was about saying, who's to blame here? Who needs to be prosecuted? How do we get them? And not looking at deeper causes and the structure of these issues.
Hence the ambulance metaphor.
Yes, indeed. The fire brigade or the ambulance metaphor.
This country is very good at that. I mean, we have vast, huge organizations and structures and the latest equipment, if you will, to extend that ambulance metaphor to a $450 billion annual thing, if you look at our spending of our Department of Defense. It doesn't seem to be working, does it? Do you think that's gotten through to the average American person, that the ambulance approach? I mean, it's good for one thing. I mean, if I get hit out here on the street, I would prefer that you airlift me to Harborview Medical Center rather than having a person start with prayers or something. Certainly, the mechanistic aspect of my body is important, but that mechanistic approach to dealing with issues, do you think America is waking up to seeing how expensive it is?
I think there is a profound occasion happening in the psyche of America where there are more and more people who are looking for quick fix, as you say, mechanistic solutions reactive responses to terror and assault and to the danger of the world, but in ways that when you really analyze this, are the beginning of the collapse of certain forms of meaning, because they're saying we have to go in and back and down to ways of looking at the world that can be formulated in terms of we are better, we are right, we are good, they are evil. And these simple polarities are really of another time and ultimately will not help, because the most fecund and creative meaning systems have to be able to stretch and breathe and relate to other meaning systems. And, you know, in consciousness we talk about cause and effect. And yes, of course, at the immediate level, you know, the terrorists who did 9/11, they are acting out of a deeply and destructively collapsed meaning set, which we call fundamentalism, because it cannot relate. It can only relate through brutal enforcement and through brutal antagonism. But that is has some basis of in this, you know, argument around cause and effect, of looking back at to the sources of their anger and the relationship in the causal weave between what we do and how they are. So we do have to try to understand why they hate us. That's a very important question. And the fact that the United States is the world's leading exporter of weapons of destruction is, you know, we would have to ask, what effect is that having in the world? How do we look at ourselves in relationship to this causal weave?
Well, I couldn't have said it better myself. Incident in Palestine, when you were there and saw a Palestinian man dealing with the ramifications of his home being destroyed, and his reaction was, I think, more akin to what you're getting at in terms of how we need to stop pointing the finger and reacting, but his reaction was to offer you a cup of coffee.
Yes, it was in the rubble of the Ain al-Halwa camp, which is about 30 miles south of Beirut, and it was a week after the massacres in the Sabra and Shatila camps, where whole families had been murdered around the dining table, where children's bodies were found murdered under the beds, where bodies littered the streets. And the camp in Ain al-Halwa had been destroyed. And when we say camp, we're talking about structures, buildings, concrete, because when you are several years, many decades in a refugee status, you move out of camps and you build bricks. And during the war with Israel, that camp had been almost flattened. And there were black rags mourning the deaths and the massacres in Sabra Shatila over these twisted pieces of wire and concrete and the remains of people's homes. And in the midst of this scene of desolation, there is this old man beckoning to me and to the medical team that was working with the Middle East Council of Churches and calling us over and saying, come have coffee. And initially we said, no, we can't do that. And he insisted, and out of the rubble, really, I think it was probably originally part of his roof, he pulled a Kalar gas stove and began to serve us Arabic coffee with incredible dignity. And if Edgar Mitchell's epiphany was coming from the moon, mine was in that place, because I looked at him and I looked at the dignity of this being. He was not about anger or rage, and I saw that no bombs can destroy that. That even though, you know, the bodies will be destroyed by bombs, that spirit, that dignity, that essence of the human being will always transcend. Our highest selves will come through. And that's been the center of my journey towards affirming the centrality and the depth and the essence of our humanness.
Wow. There are people who feel the work of IONS is too theoretical, and I definitely want to get more into talking about the specific work that IONS does. And
right.
So we'll get into that and maybe talk about people like Rupert Sheldrake and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
But there are people who say this work is too theoretical. This is, you know, we've got global warming and the destruction of forests and a hole in the ozone layer and food systems collapsing, water crises. What do you say to the people who believe the work of IONS is too theoretical and not really in touch with what's happening?
I would say that people who are still living in a world that is the world that I was certainly taught in school, that the world is out there, it is an objective reality, you can do what you like with it, you can measure it, you can dominate it, you can pick it apart, you can throw it upside down, you can experiment with it, you can create with it, but it's out there beyond you and separate. That world really, essentially, does not exist. And that our new science really returns the witnessing consciousness, the subjective witnessing consciousness of each being back into the center, because, you know, the whole field of energy and our knowledge of how matter is created and interpenetrated with energy is so real. If we could really see the structure of reality as it is now perceived in science and see that we can't even know it without a subjective interpretation. You know, subatomic particle physicists talk about probability waves, probability functions that collapse into particles when they are witnessed, when they are seen, when they are known by a subjective witness. So I would say that this is very, very big, and it hasn't really percolated into the educational streams yet, because it's so easy if you want to maintain a world that says we're separate, we're disconnected, you know, matter is something that we can simply control rather than something that we are deeply interconnected with, not only at the level of being, but at the level of energy. It transforms your relationship. And the whole notion of the being as the human being is here to dominate nature has to shift back into the place where the human being comes right back into the center of nature as a part of it, as a participant within it.
And dances, right.
Yes, indeed, beautifully.
IONS.org is the website for the Institute of Noetic Sciences. In the Northwest, IONSNW.org for more information. We're talking with James O'Dea, president of the Institute of Noetic Sciences. ¶¶